This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. Today is Friday, May 13th. Conference finals start tonight with the Tampa Bay Lightning taking on the Pittsburgh Penguins. I'm Ian Denemy here with Matt Larkin and Ryan Kennedy, and Ken Campbell is on the phone. It feels like we haven't done this in a while, right?
It's true. Too much hockey getting in the way.
Yeah, those exciting game sevens.
Yeah. Feels good to be back.
Oh, yeah. Matt just put sunglasses on.
And the Kool-Aid man came through the door.
Yeah. Speaking of sunglasses and Macho Man Randy Savage, I know someone who thought that the Slim Jim slogan was step into a Slim Jim for years, and I had a huge debate about it, but clearly when Macho Man would bite the little pepperette, he would snap it. Snap into a Slim Jim.
Snap it. Yeah, good point.
Yeah. But it was a heated debate. Like, this person assumed that somehow there was a metaphor of stepping into a piece of meat, which makes no sense.
I assume you're not friends.
Well, I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
It's a millennial thing, Ken.
Okay.
I don't know if it even is.
Well, it could be
Macho
a Gen
Man?
X thing. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, more of a Gen
X
thing.
Yeah, and I'm right on the line. It's, yeah. It's if you watched wrestling on
for
Saturday
me,
morning.
For me, Macho Man is a Village People song.
The problem with the whole millennial thing is that no one seems to have a proper definition for when that era actually is.
I just want to not be a millennial.
Like, likewise.
So Ian and I are born in 1983, so can we just say that it starts at 85?
I think I've heard that 83 might be the year. I'm 70. I'm 79, so I'm safe. I can be as grumbly and as disheveled as I want as a Gen Xer.
But I don't think an 83er fits the proper mold that we're putting millennials into.
You're a tweener.
I didn't really grow up with the internet. I remember the day we got the internet in our house.
Yeah.
I was 16, and that night I was supposed to go.
I was 10. We're the same age, by the way.
The day you got the internet in your house, you were 16.
You were 16, I'm 10.
I was 16.
Continue.
And later that night, you were watching porn. Okay, great.
Well, long story short, sort of, I was supposed to go and do this course to get certified as a referee to continue my refereeing career, and I just completely spaced and didn't go to it, and I basically stopped refereeing.
So you could have been the next Bruce Hood.
Yeah.
That's right.
But the internet derailed you. You know what I'm thinking, guys? I'm thinking right about now, anybody who's listening to this is going, I'm never getting that time back.
I can already see the comments now.
Never getting those couple of minutes back. And like when somebody's on their deathbed, they're going to be going, geez, you know, I really wish I had, you know, gotten those couple of minutes back that I listened to those guys from the Hockey News talk about
Slim
millennials and the internet.
I could have got my referee certification, but instead,
subscription canceled.
I could have been somebody, damn it.
Maybe we should just keep it going and see how long we can go without talking about hockey.
Well, the internet is all one big time suck, so I think it all kind of comes together.
It's very true.
Okay.
All right, fine. Let's talk about the Washington Capitals instead. They lost to the Pittsburgh Penguins, of course, in six games. They were the President's Trophy winners. Some had them pegged as Stanley Cup contenders or favorites. Now that they're out, what went wrong with the Capitals, and what do they have to do to fix it and become a perennial contender?
To me, it came down to just two words. I've said it before, but it's foot speed and foot speed on the defense corps. We look at Brooks Orpik's contract. That was a deal that the day he signed it, people said, hey, this is going to be a good deal for 1 or 2 years, and then it's going to be a bad deal because his body's going to break down. He's a big guy. And I just think, aside from John Carlson and Nate Schmidt at the bottom, you know, he's a 6 or 7 guy, the Caps just could not match Pittsburgh's speed. And to me, I mean, they seem like they're almost a perfect team. They won the President's Trophy. They were so balanced. But if I'm Brian McClellan in the offseason, I'm finding a way to shop for someone with good foot speed, a mobile defenseman.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of what you said, Matt. I think the Capitals got a little caught up in looking at, like, the big picture of winning the Stanley Cup. And when I say that, I think they thought what they needed was, you know, a big, you know, Western Conference kind of team, not realizing that you got to get out of the Eastern Conference or the Western Conference. And I think that was, you know, I think that's part of it is, you know, everybody talked about Washington being a Western Conference type of team that played in the Eastern Conference. But we saw in that series against Pittsburgh that, like Matt said, they just couldn't keep up to the Penguins' speed, particularly on the back end. And, you know, what you say about Orpik's contract is really true, but we're going to see that more and more in the salary cap era as things go on. You know, I mean, like, you know, look at, like, say, the Kopitar contract, for example. You know, I mean, that contract will be really good for probably another 2, maybe 3 years, and then it's going to start looking not so good. So, you know, I mean, it's the problem is, you know, you want to win now, and you have such a short window, and you think that, you know, that you have to get these guys, and you don't really worry about the future. But I would agree with you 100%, Matt. They've got to get, they've got to get some speed, and I think they've got to get some depth on their bottom, bottom six, because I think that's where Pittsburgh, you know, had a distinct advantage over them.
I would also point out that, you know, Washington made some sort of tinkering moves last summer heading into this season, where on the surface it's like, ooh, okay, Washington, like, they're just filling in the gaps, they're bringing in the pieces. Justin Williams was obviously a big one, Mr. Game 7. The Caps had always had problems in Game 7. And he did, you know, in Game 6, he had a crucial goal there to make it 3-2. But when you actually look at it, I was in Washington early in the season doing a Braden Holtby story, and at one point, I asked one of the Caps about some of the guys they brought in, TJ Oshie being one of them, of course, and Williams. I was like, yeah, you guys, you know, you added some good guys. And he said, well, yeah, but we did lose guys as well. I mean, Joel Ward was always a really good playoff performer for us. Sure enough, Joel Ward still kicking it with San Jose, doing his usual playoff heroics, being that clutch guy, giving the secondary scoring. And then you look at St. Louis, the trade partner for Oshie, they get Troy Brouwer, who has won a cup in the past. He saved St. Louis's bacon against Chicago. Meanwhile, TJ Oshie, who played very well for the Caps, still a player who has never, at least in the pro ranks, gotten a team to a championship or won that big international medal, even though he was great in the shootout at the Olympics. Team USA still didn't get that gold. I wonder if that mix of winners just wasn't quite there yet. You know, you still have Ovechkin and Backstrom and Kuznetsov and all these core guys, Carlson and Alsner. Obviously, they've never won a cup because they're, you know, they're lifelong Capitals. But the tweaking moves, on the surface, they seem pretty good. But now in hindsight, it's like, maybe you should have done all you could to hang on to Joel Ward. Maybe he was kind of the guy you needed.
Well, I think too, though, that they probably expected that some of their younger guys were going to play a little bit better than they did. I mean, Kuznetsov, for as great as he was during the regular season, was not very good in the playoffs. Mm. You know, I mean, Andrei Burakovsky, another guy that I think, you know, you've got to, you know, these guys, Tom Wilson, and I mean, I know Tom Wilson is never going to be an offensive force, but, you know, I mean, these guys have to make that step. They have to make that next step. And I think a guy like Kuznetsov, you know, I think he learned what the playoffs were really all about this year, and I would expect he's going to be a better player for it. And in future years, he's going to step it up in the playoffs and be a more productive player. But they need those younger guys that they have, some of those younger guys that they have, you know, to really step up and, you know, start to take more prominent roles and be players that they can count on a little more in clutch situations.
Yeah. And again, you know, something that I've talked about in the past is the idea of you always got to step on the neck in hockey. When you got a team down, you just got to do it. And when Washington was getting all those puck over the glass penalties that Pittsburgh was taking in that crucial game, you know, they managed to tie it up, but they didn't take the lead. And then, you know, I think it was maybe a minute or two later, Chris Letang takes a bad interference penalty. Washington can't capitalize. What happens? Pittsburgh wins an OT. Series over. That was their stretch. Like, when I was watching that game, I was like, it's over. Washington's winning this. Mm. Not so much.
And it's a good point, Ken. I'm glad you mentioned Tom Wilson, because to me, he's a great example of what you were saying before. Tom Wilson in a Western Conference series, boom, boom, boom. Big bruiser, but he's a monster. And yes, he's reasonably mobile for a guy his size, but what was very fascinating about Tom Wilson to me is I barely remember him in the second round. He was taken right out of that series.
No effect because he probably
not fast enough.
Up the pace, and he probably couldn't. You know, he couldn't play at that level of competition. Which you know, which goes back to my point. You know, yeah,
exactly,
you're
right. Exactly. And the thing about Kuznetsov, he's a great player, and you know, some people are worried about him. He's going to be fine, and it sounds weird to make it so simple, but I really think he just needs to go to the weight room. To me, the problem over and over was he was literally shoved off the puck again and again and again. His upper body strength seemed to be lacking when it came time to that trench warfare. Maybe certain plays that would be penalties in the regular season were let go in the playoffs, so guys are getting away with just being rougher with him, and it seemed like he just wasn't ready for it.
Similarly, not quite as sexy a team, but what do we make of the Nashville Predators? They, you know, they got within a game of advancing to the third round. You know, they're relatively young, but they're, you know, again, they're kind of a middling lower half of the playoff seed. Are they just kind of there, or are they on the up and up?
Yeah. To be honest, like for me, this was their ceiling. I thought it was pretty impressive that they pushed San Jose as far as they did, but you know, Ryan Johansson, he has the potential to be an elite number one center, but he's not a number one center right. He's not an elite number one center right now. Mike Ribeiro, healthy scratch for a couple of games, not a player that you really want to hang your hat on in any sense of that word. You know, you can talk about Shea Weber's failings in Game 7. I don't think that's necessarily the death knell of his career or anything like that, but I think Nashville basically played as far as they could. Maybe you should have gotten a little more scoring for Philip Forsberg, but you know, this is a team that doesn't have a really high ceiling for offense, and as good as your goaltending and defense can be, I mean, you still got to put points on the board at the end of the day. So I think this is a team that they got to grow some more talent. They got to push out a couple of guys that that might not have the fight you need in the playoffs, and then we can talk about them being a true contender.
Yeah, I agree with what, a lot of what you're saying, Ryan. Like when is Colin Wilson ever going to play like this ever again?
You know, next year, I mean, in the playoffs. Not until then, though.
Yeah, I mean they had to jump on that. They had to capitalize on that. I don't agree with you on Ryan Johansson. By the way, I thought when that trade was made that was a trade that the Nashville Predators were going to live to regret. You know, I don't think Ryan Johansson is a number one center. I think he's a good secondary player. He'd be a good second line center, but you know, I mean, he got eaten alive. There were points in this series where he got eaten alive by the Sharks, and I just thought he was really out of his element a couple of times. You know, and I think one thing we do know about the Nashville Predators is, you know, they go as Shea Weber goes, because when he's brutal, they're brutal. And like last night was a perfect example. I mean, he had an uncharacteristically, cataclysmically bad game, and you know, you saw the result. So I think, you know, they're still leaning pretty hard on that, you know, that Weber Josi pairing, and I think he's still the guy there, because when he doesn't play well, you know, they're sunk.
And I'm also worried about Pekka in the long term. And it's not about Game 7. You know, we had the meltdown, but I think the meltdown was deserved in Game 7. He had no help. There were good goals on him. But as a whole, $7 million for three more seasons. He's, I believe, 33 years old now. And he's a goalie. I call him the eye test goalie. He's 6'6". He's athletic. We had our THN poll with retired goalies. They ranked him number 2 overall behind Carey Price. But the numbers do not support that. Rene, I think in 2 of the last 3 seasons, maybe 3 of the last 4, he's been average to below average at stopping the puck, literally stopping the puck from going in the net. His save percentage is subpar. This year he had a horrible season. He bounced back a bit in the playoffs, but was still inconsistent at times. And the Predators, I think they're stuck with Rene. There aren't too many teams that need a number one goaltender. It's not a contract that's easy to move. I think UC Saros is still a little while away from being ready to be an NHL starter, and he's tiny. He's 5'10", so that's already working against him. So to me, it looks like Nashville will roll with Rene again next year, and that could be a problem. I mean, Carter Hutton this year, for the first time ever, replaced Rene in back-to-back games. So he played 2 in a row when Rene was healthy and able, and that was the sign to me that they're losing confidence in Rene.
All right, well, let's move on and talk about the series to come. We'll start with the Tampa Bay Lightning and Pittsburgh Penguins in the Eastern Conference. Tampa Bay, are they good, or were they just fortunate to face the Red Wings and Islanders, two of the not-so-good playoff teams?
I think they're both. I think they're good, and they were fortunate. Mm-hmm. I think they were really fortunate, actually. They played the worst team in the playoffs in the first round, and got by them. But the Islanders gave them a bit of a fight, which was, which I think brought out some really good things in this team. And I think they are a really good team, and they have obviously got some real depth there. Overcoming the injuries and the adversity that they've had to overcome this year, but I don't see it being enough against this Pittsburgh team. I just think that Pittsburgh's had a far more difficult road to this point. And to me, the whole sort of tipping point is, we don't know if Stroman and or Stamkos are going to be back in this series, but we do know that Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin are going to be playing in this series. And they got virtually nothing from Crosby and Malkin in terms of offensive production in the last series, and they still won. And I just can't imagine that that's going to continue to be the case. So I think the depth and just the speed and everything that Pittsburgh has, I think it's going to be too much for Tampa Bay.
I agree, Ken. I do think Pittsburgh is going to edge out Tampa Bay. I think the series is going to be close. But to talk about Tampa Bay a little bit more, I think they've really shown something in these playoffs, and it's that they are a star-studded team when Stamkos isn't even in the lineup. And Nikita Kucherov's got 9 goals in 10 games in the playoffs. I think Ben Bishop's been the best overall goalie in the playoffs. And for all the talk of Braden Holtby, I personally think Ben Bishop was the best goalie in the regular season as well. He was super consistent. I think his worst save percentage in any month was .916, if I remember correctly. Tyler Johnson's back playing the way he was before last year. Jonathan Drouin finally given a chance, and anytime he's been put in the top six, he produces. So we're seeing this core, and Victor Hedman, of course, as well. And this is a core that if you want to re-sign all of them over the next two seasons, that also includes Andre Palat, Vlad Nemestikov, I think you have to let Steven Stamkos walk. So to me, it's almost like maybe it's a happy accident, but this entire roster core is saying, hey, look at us. Look what we can do on our own. We're already a complete hockey team. And if you add Stamkos back to the equation in these playoffs, if he can find his way back, that's a scary proposition, although I still don't believe Stamkos is going to make it back.
Yeah, there were times in that Islanders series when they were under siege and early in games when I was looking, I was going, man, this team misses Anton Stroman a lot more than it misses Steven Stamkos right now.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to go a different way on this, though. Even though I picked Pittsburgh to make the Stanley Cup final originally, I think I downgraded Tampa too much because of those injuries to Stroman and Stamkos, and then Victor Hedman was banged up heading into the playoffs as well. For me, there's a couple of keys. One is Brian Boyle is playing fantastic in a shutdown role and even putting in some secondary offense, which is nice for them. And, when you're playing a Pittsburgh team that has Crosby, Malkin, and Kessel all on different lines, clearly you need to be a four-line team. I think Tampa Bay has that. One thing that I think is going to be very interesting, Matt Murray has been a great story for Pittsburgh in net, but it really seems like savvy folk like Justin Williams figured out you can beat him high because he goes down, he covers that corner of the net, and he goes down pretty easily in that respect. I can see Tampa Bay feasting on that, especially a guy like Jonathan Drouin, the triplets. These are sharp-shooting guys, and with the benefit of a little bit of scouting now that they've got a sample size on Murray, I can't help but think that Tampa's got all those big dudes on the blue line. It's not just Hedman, but Braden Coburn's playing great. You got Andre Suster, who's obviously more of a depth guy, but he's huge. You look at the way they shut down John Tavares in the latter part of that series. John Tavares is a scary dude when he's got the puck. And he was rendered almost obsolete in the latter half of that series. So a couple of sort of, I don't know if they're unsexy factors, but part of me just can't shake the fact that Tampa's got some answers that I don't know if we've given them credit for yet.
It's interesting. I'm the resident Matt Murray defender, so I want to have a little Matt Murray rebuttal.
Don't you dare
talk about Matt Murray that
he's my
way.
Boy. He's my child.
I spoke to, for an issue of THN, I was doing something on goalie development, and I spoke to a bunch of goalie coaches, and I spoke with Jim Rutherford, Penguins GM, about Matt Murray for a while, and the one thing he kept repeating and going back to was Matt Murray's mental toughness, short memory, ability to adapt when things go wrong and bounce back and just have sort of a steely resolve. And if you look at what he's faced in the playoffs so far, he had his first career playoff start in Madison Square Garden, staring across the ice at Henrik Lundqvist. Gave up one goal, got a shutout the next game at MSG. Next series, he's staring across from Braden Holtby. He's facing Alex Ovechkin. It doesn't seem to matter what you throw at Murray. All these high-stakes situations, he seems to find a way, and his numbers have been great in the playoffs. Even though, yes, he's looked a little more beatable here and there, he still strikes me as a goalie who he bounces back. So I'm still not worried about him, even though it's going to be the third series in a row where the Penguins are supposed to be at a disadvantage. They're facing another elite goalie. I still think they're going to keep getting good goaltending. To me, the more interesting question is, will the Penguins do the wrong thing and put Marc-Andre Fleury in the lineup? As a star.
No, they can't. They just can't.
I hope not.
Like, can they really? Like, seriously?
Feels like it's been too long.
And the guy's had a checkered playoff pass to as it is, you know, and he's missed all this time. And Matt Murray's playing so well. Like, I just, wow, that would be, to me, that would be a shocker.
Yeah,
that would be a huge shock. I just can't imagine. Is the leash probably a little shorter on Matt Murray now that Marc-Andre Fleury's ready to jump back into the crease? I would think so. But I just can't imagine you would even entertain the thought of starting anybody but Matt Murray at this point.
I hope you're right, Ken. It makes me nervous that a lot of the Pittsburgh beat writers found the urge this morning felt it necessary to tweet out, by the way, Matt Murray's first off the ice, as if it was in question. That's what has me wondering, hey, is Fleury in play here? I hope
but
not.
If he's first off the ice, that means he's playing.
Yes, but the fact that they felt the need to tell people.
That means he's the starter.
Yes, but the fact that they felt they had to everyone, right?
Yeah. I think that was probably just everybody saying, okay, you know, it's going to be Murray tonight. So, I can't see them doing anything but starting with Matt Murray. And if he falters, which I don't think he's going to, then they've got a pretty good plan B. So,
All right, let's move on to the Western Conference. St. Louis Blues, San Jose Sharks, two teams that have this narrative of being playoff chokers. They've both knocked off some really good teams to get here. One of them's going to the Stanley Cup Final at last. Who's it going to be?
Oh man, they can't both choke. It's impossible. Maybe no one will win. I don't know. I just get a San Jose Sharks vibe right now. I mean, Logan Couture is playing out of his mind. Joe Pavelski really seems to be. Joe Pavelski has won at every level. I know that's been quoted in other places, but like USHL, NCAA, this is kind of the last frontier for him that he hasn't conquered. He might have even won high school, for all I know.
Joe Pavelski is the number one center for the U.S. World Cup team right now.
Yeah. Fantastic player.
Without question.
Yeah, fantastic player. I mean, Thornton, Burns, Marlowe, all playing well. Martin Jones, I mean, you barely even ever talk about Martin Jones because you don't need to. He just does his thing.
You only had to make 20 saves, I think, in Game 7. So yeah. He's getting the Ken Dryden treatment.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, so, you know, he just does his job very quietly and nice, and that's all. And they've gotten this far. It's hard to poke holes in them.
Yeah, so little to choose between these two teams, though. Like, two teams, like, as you said, Ian, that have, you know, have had their playoff demons in the past. You know, they both, you know, they both sort of had little hiccups along the way, and then in Game 7 of the last two series were absolutely dominant, both teams. Both teams, big, strong teams that can cycle the puck and good possession teams. There's just so little to choose. And I guess, you know, like you said, Ryan, it comes down to what you're feeling. And I don't know, for some reason, I'm feeling St. Louis. I just think that this team is a team that finally has gotten it. They finally realized, you know, that, you know, this, I mean, both of these teams, I think, you know, I mean, the window for winning is always so short for everybody. But, you know, I think both of these teams realize that, that this is, they're in a pretty unique position now. You know, how many years is Chicago, are Chicago and LA going to lose in the first round? And so I think they realize where they're at, and I think that the Blues get it. They, you know, they just, for whatever reason, I think they're, you know, they're just a team of destiny right now, and that would be the only thing that would make me pick them over San Jose. I think it's a dead heat. I think it's a pick'em series. It's probably going to go seven, and I'm just feeling St. Louis.
And I will say, Paul Stastny has really impressed me this series. He always struck me as a guy in the past that, you know, was part of the reason, whether it was the Blues or Colorado before that, but, you know, he was part of that Blues core that had a bit of a stink on them. They could never sort of take it to the next level. But the way he's played this year, along with some of the other, you know, with Troy Brouwer, Robbie Fabbri, Colton Parayko, guys that haven't been part of that core in the past, who I think came with fresh eyes and a fresh sort of approach, fresh mental approach to the game, I think Stastny has really elevated just his compete level, and he's getting the results because of it. And it is kind of interesting to see, like, you know, these aren't the St. Louis Blues of the past, even though you have a lot of the same guys. To me, it's really fascinating to see Paul Stastny step up.
And I agree, guys. I think it's a razor-thin series margin. I lean slightly towards San Jose just because, to me, this seems to be a magical year where the Sharks' best players are all peaking at the same time. And Joe Thornton's best season was 05-06, but this is at least his best season in 6 or 7 years. Brent Burns' best season, one of the best seasons by a defenseman in the last 10 years, I'd say, at least offensively. And Joe Pavelski, who continues to be, it feels like he's underrated, I don't know, somehow, but to me he's almost a top 10 player in the game. And all of them are at their peak at the same time. I would argue that they had three Hart Trophy candidates this year, between Pavelski, Burns, and Thornton. Three legit Hart Trophy candidates. And then, to top it all off, Logan Couture busts out in the playoffs and starts realizing his potential again. I just think the Sharks' best players are a bit better than the Blues' best right now, and I think that's going to be the difference in what should be a seven-game series.
All right. Before we call it a day, we've got a couple of reader questions to address today. We'll stick with the Blues and Sharks, actually, because reader Dan Woody asks, can Robbie Fabbri stay active and productive and not shrink under the spotlight as the Blues move on?
I think so. He's a big game player. Took Guelph all the way to the Memorial Cup final and played really well in those OHL playoffs. And let's not forget that he has a great supporting cast. This is not the Robbie Fabbri show. I suspect that in maybe like 2-3 years, it will be Fabbri and Tarasenko, that will be the name of the show in St. Louis. But right now, you still have Alex Steen, David Backes, Paul Stastny. You have a ton of offensive weapons. So the great benefit of Robbie Fabbri is he gives you a bit of a different look, being just, you know, like a high-paced, finesse guy. But he doesn't have to do it alone.
I don't think he's going to fade because he's so involved. Like, this is not a guy that's getting his goals from the periphery or, you know, benefiting from, you know, tap-ins from, you know, passes from line mates. This is a guy that gets in. Like, you know, I mean, look at the first goal the other night in Game 7. I mean, he was right in that, you know, he was right in the crease area, right, you know, digging for the puck. And this is a kid who's got a lot of gumption, he's got a lot of grit to him. You know, that line with Stastny and Brouwer is just absolutely lights out right now. And as you said, Ryan, this is a kid that's won at every level. I mean, I watched him play in the OHL Cup against Connor McDavid, and, you know, that great Toronto Marlies team. He played for the Mississauga Rebels, and he was the best player on the ice in that game. And, you know, then you go through his junior year. He should have been playing on the World Junior team and actually was on it until he got hurt. So there's nothing in this guy's, you know, past or anything to suggest that he's going to become a shrinking violet at any time soon. And I just think, you know, I think this guy's, you know, I mean, he's one of the really, really terrific young players in the game right now. And, you know, I see him continuing to have a big impact on this series as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned Fabry's past. You and I were in Traverse City in the fall, Ken, and Fabry was there playing for St. Louis's prospect team. For those who don't know, it's an 8-tournament team that the Red Wings host every summer. And Fabry was playing for St. Louis. And what I was so impressed with was how he used his speed to forecheck and make life miserable. He had a pitched battle with Gustav Olofsson, the Minnesota Wild defense prospect, that was just amazingly intense hockey, which was kind of hilarious for the setting, given that, you know, it was the summertime. But that's what impressed me about Fabry, is he uses his speed not just to get goals, but to get in on the forecheck, to make life difficult for defenders, to take away time and space. And when you talk to great shutdown players, that's like the only answer they give away, you know, they ever give you is, oh, you just got to take away so-and-so's time and space. Fabry does that as a young forward, and to me, it was very impressive to see.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy that 4 years ago was playing minor midget hockey. 4 years ago was playing minor midget hockey. Now he's got 13 points in the playoffs, and he's in the conference final.
And the thing about Fabry is he likes adversity. I talked to him when we did our rookie issue, and he kept referencing his injury that forced him out of the World Juniors, the concussion he had at the start of this year, and he keeps spinning it positively, saying, "Oh, no, it was a roadblock for me to overcome. I got a chip on my shoulder," and he feels like it made him stronger. He spent more time getting better, focusing on all the little details of his game, and he's the opposite of a guy who crumbles under the spotlight to me, and I think we're going to see that throughout his career. I think he's going to grow into a big-game player over the next 10, 15 years.
Okay, next question is from Stephen Birch. He wants to know how we think this playoff year has impacted perceptions of analytics, essentially. You know, are these playoffs proving that analytics win?
Well, all I can say to that is that our analytics guy, Dom, whatever his last name is, I can never pronounce it, has already won our playoff bracket because he picked the four conference finalists. So, and he's the numbers guy, and he's got it bang on. So obviously he's doing something right.
And the correlation, it's stronger and stronger each year. We've been looking at the Stanley Cup champions, and there's I think it's six or seven in a row finished top two in Corsi, something like that. So there's such a strong link between the Cup champion and being an amazing possession team. And seven of the top eight in the second round, the eight teams that made the second round, seven of them were top 10 possession teams in the league. And Pittsburgh looks like it could be the team of destiny, and that's a team that they were struggling. And the one thing that changed significantly when Mike Sullivan took over, I've crunched these numbers, their possession, they were bottom of the league, near the bottom of the league, and they skyrocketed to second only to the LA Kings for the rest of the season. And that's, we've seen what's happened to them, right? They play a completely different style. They just relentlessly attack the opposition. Speed, speed, speed. And even speed from the blue line, guy like Trevor Daley. And it's interesting because people are saying the Penguins another question on Twitter, are they the new modern model for success? And, I mean, maybe the Kings deserve that credit. They're the dominant possession team. But it is interesting that it seems like the Penguins are built for possession hockey. And Trevor Daley is the guy that stands out to me, someone who looked like he was written off. His career was on the downslope. Chicago traded him for a song. No offense to Rob Scuderi. But Daley's style, his speed and his ability to move the puck, it fits into this Penguin system. And even in a game with no Letang and no Alimata, the Penguins still win that game against Washington. And because Daley plays so well, he just fits the system.
Yeah, and if you need...
Their zone entries seem so much more effective now than they were before, and I think that's been a big part of the reason why they've been able to create so much offense. They gain the zone, and they gain it with guys like Crosby and guys like that, who can carry the puck and can get faster while they're carrying the puck.
Yeah. And if you need just a final example, you know, you look at Washington, President's Trophy winner, they were not a great possession team. And that's, to be honest, that's why I didn't pick them to go very far in the playoffs. I had Pittsburgh beating Washington in that series in my office bracket. Now, disregard the fact that I had the Kings winning it all. But Washington was just kind of an okay possession team, and it just seems like it keeps coming up again. And I am not a math guy by any stretch of the imagination, but it's hard to ignore those patterns, and it's hard to ignore which teams are missing the playoffs, which teams are making it, and it's also easy to see Dallas is a great possession team, but we knew their Achilles heel was goaltending. And that's something that we've seen in the past, too. Good goaltending, like in Montreal, can cover up your possession mistakes, but it can only take you so far. And I think there's a really easy pattern to be sussed out here.
And the thing about Dallas, too, was Dallas was a great possession team, but not a complete possession team. Completely dominant in the offensive numbers, but if you looked at only their defensive possession numbers, they were subpar. So there you go, not complete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and their defense was not good.
All right, that'll do it. I guess another shout-out to Dom.
Let's say Lucision. We'll call. I think that's his last name.
Lucinski.
Lucinich.
I think it's Lucision. Like Curtis Lucision.
Like Curtis Lucision?
I don't think it's Lucision.
No, it can't be Lucision.
I'm wise after it.
Hey, Dom, what's your last name? Are you listening?
We're going to take our first call ever.
This isn't even a college yet.
All right. We'll do this again in a couple weeks to preview the Stanley Cup Finals. Until then, visit THN.com for all your playoff news. Thanks for listening.